And welcome back to This Green Earth. And now I have the pleasure of speaking with world-renowned wildlife biologist Diane Boyd. Now, Diane has spent 4 decades studying and advocating for wolves in the wilds of Montana near Glacier National Park, and was the only female biologist in the U.S. researching and radio-calling wild wolves in the 1970s. In her new book, A Woman Among Wolves, Boyd takes readers on a wild ride from the early days of wolf research to the present day challenges of wolf management. Diane, thank you so much for joining us today on This Green Earth.
Oh, thank you, Claire. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we are happy to have you. I am super intrigued about your studies. What led you to go into this type of research and this type of work? Did you start out as a kid being intrigued by wildlife? When did you get bit by the bug to do this as a career?
Oh, it started early. I grew up in the suburbs of Minneapolis, and so it was not out in the country, but I had a swamp nearby, as we call it. Now it's called a wetland, but this wonderful swamp to run around in as a kid and explore and find duck nests and, you know, hear the birds and catch frogs and salamanders. Anyway, I grew up just seeking out those kind of experiences. And then as I got to the point where I could drive in high school, I started going further afield and going on little solo camping trips. And it's just who I am. I don't know how to answer that otherwise.
So you had this innate draw to nature. And when you started studying this and becoming a researcher in this very distinctive path of wolves, where did that take place, and when did you really start to dive deep into this species?
Well, I was always interested in wolves starting in high school, but I really wanted to start school and be a veterinarian. And I worked for a vet in the Twin Cities area, and as soon as I had done that, then I knew I wasn't going to be my calling. I really wanted to do something more wild and more remote. And as it happened, Dave Meach was on my campus where I went to the university, and he is the wolf researcher premier. And so I just kept bugging him to volunteer, to work for him, to learn about wolves, and eventually that came to fruition, and I've just continued to follow that path.
And there is such a breadth of information to take in about the history of wolves. Can you share with me how you experienced taking in that information, and what are some of the biggest takeaways about the history of wolves? They're such a beautiful, wonderful creature, and they do so much for ecosystems, but they can be polarizing. So can you walk us through some of the really fundamental historical facts about wolves?
Got to remember that history is written by humans, and we recall it with our biases. But wolf history is, wolves have always been an incredibly successful species on the planet, and they're just out there doing their thing and, you know, trying to catch food and trying to raise young and trying to stay alive. But from human history, we've had a very passionate, I'll put it that way, viewpoint on wolves, either extreme, the wolf haters and the wolf lovers. And that continues to this day, despite some really good science that's out there and has gotten into the hands of the public, but there's still a lot of bumps to smooth over, that's for sure.
Yeah, and the history of wolves in North America, they were here for quite some time. There's a long history of wolves, and then they were eradicated. What happened there? What was it that drove out the wolves in the beginning?
So the gray wolves came over the Bering Land Bridge, you know, glacial times. Oh gosh, the dates vary, but probably about 10,000 years ago or so, before present. And they basically were incredibly successful, and they ranged from Alaska and the Arctic of Canada all the way to Mexico, and they covered the continent. And it's very interesting because there's no evidence that they walked down to South America, which I ponder that sometimes. Why didn't they keep going? But anyway, and when people came over following them, the indigenous peoples, they didn't have the probably the desire or the ability to wipe out wolves on a mass destruction scale. And when our European relatives, colonizers, came in to settle the continent, I think the first wolf bounty law was made in the 1600s or something, but they did their best to just kill all the wolves. And then there was a very strong government program, especially in the late 1800s, early 1900s, to kill every last wolf, including those that are inside the national park. And they were pretty well wiped out in most places by the 1930s.
And was this because of a perceived conflict, a human-wolf conflict that had arisen? Was it because of livestock? Was it because of stories told about wolves and they seemed to be on the aggressive side? What were those things that led to their destruction?
The European colonists brought their anti-wolf biases with them from the old country in Europe. And when they colonized North America and pushed out the Native Americans, they pushed out and exterminated a lot of wildlife species, so sort of the manifest destiny scenario. And, you know, wolves kill livestock sometimes, but not any more so than mountain lions or grizzly bears or, you know, disease. And there's all kinds of things that kill livestock. But we had the tools, traps, guns, poisons, to do a really thorough job eradicating them, and that's what's happened. So, like I said, by about the 1930s is the date that's cited, there really were not strong viable populations of wolves anywhere anymore in the lower 48, except for Minnesota. There were a few stragglers, hanger oner there, but not in great numbers. I mean, Minnesota has never exterminated its wolves because it's got the vast Boundary Water Canoe Area wilderness to the north, which is connected to the Canadian populations. And so there's not water between northern Minnesota and the Canadian populations. But where the ice bridges did happen was when Lake Superior froze over occasionally. It doesn't do it much anymore. Mm-hmm. Those wolves, a pair of wolves, then colonized Isle Royale in Lake Superior, which is actually technically Michigan, not right. Minnesota, in about the 1950s. When I left Minnesota in 1979, there was between 900 and 1,000 wolves in the state at that time.
Wow. So let's talk about the physiology of a wolf. What separates them? What makes them unique physically?
So wolves have a huge amount of genetic plasticity, behavioral plasticity, and morphological plasticity, meaning they can kind of adapt to be anywhere, any habitat. They're prey generalists. So unlike the lynx, for example, lynx are very specific, tied into snowshoe hare. Wolves can eat anything from, you know, beavers and rodents to moose, and they do, and they will. And they're very resilient, and they're very clever. So their physiology, their physical size, is shaped by the prey animals that they hunt. So, say in Minnesota, the wolves are slightly smaller, maybe 20% smaller than our Rocky Mountain wolves, because they live on mostly white-tailed deer and about 40% beaver in some of the spots studied. And here in the West, they live on elk and deer, sometimes moose, sometimes bighorn sheep. So, therefore, the wolves in the West are larger to take down larger prey.
How big is a wolf? How much do they weigh normally?
Well, a wolf here in the Rockies, on average, an adult female goes about 90 pounds, and an average adult male goes about 105 or so. I've caught him as large as 121 pounds. I think the record wolf trapped here in the West that was weighed in Yellowstone was 141 pounds. And, you know, younger animals are smaller. So, it depends on the animal's rank, or it rides in the pack as to how big it is.
Mm. And what do they mean to an ecosystem? What is the wolf's role in an ecosystem?
Well, wolves are very good balancers, I would say. They just take prey, whatever is the most abundant. And if, say, like in our ecosystem, they prey on mule deer, white-tailed deer, elk, moose, occasionally bighorn sheep, but not very often. And if say something happens, like we have chronic wasting disease or epizootic hemorrhagic disease, also called blue tongue, if something comes through one of those game populations and really depresses the number of a certain species, wolves are able to switch prey and prey on something else. People like to say they take the old, the sick, and the weak, which is more or less true, but I like to say they take the vulnerable, which is generally the old or the sick or the weak, but they can take a perfectly healthy animal if, say, snow conditions are in favor of the wolves. A big, heavy crust on a snow where the wolves can run on top and their prey breaks through. So then they just take whatever they can catch. So they thin out the herd. They can have impacts on the coyote population and do some population dynamics there with coyotes and fox. And having wolves in an ecosystem is how Mother Nature created the world. I mean, they're part of it. And when we remove them, a lot of puzzle pieces move around or fall away.
Yeah, I love the way you put that because it isn't a full picture when you have a species that is meant to be there. When they are taken away, it does change and have a ripple effect and change what that puzzle looks like. So,
Yes, for sure.
yeah, in your decades-long work here, what was a day like in your life? Take us through a typical day for you.
Well, it's more seasonal. A typical day in the summer would be I or we. A lot of times I had some really amazing technicians and volunteers. We would go out and radio track the wolves and get locations, usually from the ground with the antenna or from an airplane. And that was prior to the days of satellite GPS collars where you can locate them automatically and remotely, and you don't have to do anything to get that data except catch them. And so we would get locations, and I would use their locations to be able to set out a trap line to try and capture and collar more wolves. We would go in after they abandoned their den in the fall. We'd go in and go to their rendezvous sites and their den sites and pick up scats for food habits and collect specimens. The winter time, the routine was really my favorite. In the winter time, we would get up and we would have radio tracked the wolves daily, so we'd know where they were the day before or the day before that. And then part of the crew would go out and spend the day radio tracking these animals via truck and snowmobile. And then most of the crew got to go out on skis, wade across the North Fork of the Flathead River in winter, which is, looking back, is pretty hazardous actually. It's a big, deep, fast river. And then we would cut the wolf tracks and ski backwards along their tracks and travel opposite to the direction that they were so that we weren't following them and pushing them. And that way we would get to see their natural behavior without affecting it. And by tracking in the snow, you're going as the wolf goes. And you pause where they pause, you see what they see, you can see where they defecated or urinated, you could collect samples at kills, you could see where they slept, you could look at the habitat they used. I mean, it's just amazing to read the story the wolves write in the snow as they travel.
I love that too. I love the way you put that, the story of the wolves. So, as you are learning this story, what kind of social aspects did they have? What was their society like socially?
When we were studying the wolves, we did our best to be remote and not to disturb them. It was very different from Yellowstone now, where they have people, wolf watchers, that are always watching them and seeing them a lot because of the terrain. And so nowadays, they can really assess social structure and dominance. And back, when we couldn't, because the areas I studied in the Northern Rockies here were heavily densely forested. You never saw the wolves. I mean, if you did, you were messing up on your job because your job was to not disturb the wolves, right? But we did know from the radio callers who the breeding females were, where the dens were located, and when we had airplane flights, we could watch them from the air, and you can determine by tail posture and interactions who's the top dog. I caught handled scores of wolves in my career, and they're not aggressive in a trap. You think they would be. They're not. They're terrified. They want to get away from you.
Right. So what were those traps used for, and what was the purpose behind trapping the wolves?
So because we were living in and researching in a very dense, mature canopy forests, or, you know, northern forests, we couldn't use helicopters to dart wolves. And it was really expensive to do that, even if we could, versus Yellowstone, where the terrain is open and they routinely helicopter dart the wolves. So we had to go back to the old-fashioned foothold traps, and we bought lots of traps and modified the traps to minimize damages and to be humane and check them really often and did all these things because I didn't want to damage the wolves. I wanted to simply put a collar on them so we could study them. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to be studying animals that had handicaps. So we did everything we could to minimize it. But yeah, they're kind of the standard old ugly traps with a few modifications.
So when you're going between being a scientist and then someone who has worked with these wolves as a human being and grows an affinity for this species, how do those two interact between the science side of you and the human side of you?
That's a really good question. I discuss that quite a bit in my book, A Woman Among Wolves, and I talk about that, the professional scientist side and the personal side, because I'm obviously feel strongly about wolves, but I'm also a, you know, PhD published researcher who takes their career seriously. So I found that if I didn't get all emotionally wrought over things, got along a lot better with people I was talking with, and it was better for the wolves, not fueling fires. Mm. So, you know, I used science and stories to weave facts into a language that's comfortable and I guess graspable for anybody.
Sure. And in the book, A Woman Among Wolves, you really write this as your memoir, and all this time spent with them, all this time researching and the information that you gathered. What was it that was most surprising to you over all those years? What is something that still strikes you as being a very unique piece of information?
Two things, really, because when I came here from Minnesota, wolves at that time in 79 only existed in the northern quarter of the state, maybe northern third, probably quarter, because it was wilderness that they could escape into and it wasn't roaded, is Boundary Waters canoe area, and they were not accessible for people to kill them off. That's why they survived. So people, including me, had the idea that wolves are denizens of the wild and the wilderness areas only, and that they need vast tracts that are peopleless to survive. And I learned pretty quickly that isn't true. And you'll see everywhere they've gone now, they have learned how to adapt to be among people. Those that aren't smart or are too bold are killed. Those that are a little more shy survive. So that's the first fact, which is they aren't denizens of the wilderness necessarily. They just need to live someplace where people can't kill them so easily. And the second thing I learned was really amazing to me was just how resilient they are, that they are really, really adaptable. And you can put a lot of pressure on a population by killing off a huge percentage of them, and they will do their best to rebound and have more breeding animals and recruit more pups, and they'll just carry on. The wolves that came to Montana walked here from Canada, from Banff and Jasper and points beyond, and nobody brought them here. And this is a story that's never been told. It's not a big, sexy $1 million, you know, reintroduction operation. It's not, it's just a few wolves that were sneaky and smart enough to tiptoe their way down the Rocky Mountain gauntlet and survive the run and land in the North Fork of the Flathead, in Glacier Park, and in a community that accepted and tolerated them. There was no livestock here. So they got a toehold, so to speak, and just proceeded to do well. But all the wolves that came into Northwest Montana, nobody brought them here. And that's a really important point to stress.
And what time frame was that those wolves came across?
Well, from 1979 with the first one, Kishnina, to present time. And eventually, these wolves here have mixed and mingled with wolves from Idaho and Yellowstone because they're huge dispersers. I mean, going 500 miles is a walkabout for a wolf of a few weeks. It's nothing. So they're very capable of colonizing new areas on their own without being reintroduced. I mean, that's how wolves got to Washington and Oregon and California and Michigan and Wisconsin. Those wolves walked from Minnesota. Nobody put them there.
Right. So they can cover quite some ground. And like you said, it's how they operate.
They're like Usain Bolt. they're running machines, and they are constantly moving. When they're on the move all the time, they're patrolling their territories and looking for trespassers and catching prey and exploring. And then when they really finally leave their home, they disperse. They might go 30 miles, they might go 300, they might go 800. And we didn't know all that until the advent of radio collars. And now, and in my later years of my career, we put on the GPS satellite collars. And so you're able to stay with the wolf and find them. Versus in the early part of my career, they were VHF collars, very high frequency. And you had to physically go out and be within an antenna distance of tracking those wolves to get them. If they were further away, you just lost them. So radio collars created an amazing amount of really cool information on dispersal.
When we talk about packs of wolves, what is a common number for them to travel in?
It depends on the prey base and the human harvest regime. So prior to recovery, our wolves here pack might have been 10 or 11. And now since they're shooting and trapping a lot of them every year, I think the average pack size now is about 6. And some of the packs in Yellowstone have been enormous because they sometimes have multiple females in a pack breed. So you can have 15 pups born in a year. So, I mean, packs are very dynamic.
The pack numbers are just dependent on the ecosystem in which they mostly hang.
Depends, yeah, on the prey availability and habitat and how densely populated it is. The more wolves are packed into an area, the smaller the packs are probably going to be. But it varies. And then wolves that traverse in the where caribou are the main prey, up in the tundra, their territories are thousands of square miles because their prey is migratory. You know, in Minnesota and Wisconsin, maybe Michigan, territories can be 100 square miles, mm-hmm, or less, maybe. And here in Rocky Mountains, they're about 200 square miles. So
wow.
It's really variable. They're tough. That adaptability and resilience really surprised me. I thought these were really creatures of the wild and they had to be in remote places and, you know, they had to have everything perfect. And if there was something wasn't perfect, they'd die. And it's like, nah, they're really adaptable like a coyote. They really are.
Wow.
And that's why I think they've become the most successful endangered species recovery story that I can think of. I can't think of another species that in 40 years has completely repopulated and met its criteria to be removed from the endangered species list everywhere it's been. It's really incredible.
That's really interesting. In all these years, why was it important for you to get this information out now? Why did you want to put this work into the world?
That gets down to why did I write the book? And it's because I started working with wolves back in 1977, actually, in Minnesota, 76. And at that time, they were quite rare and they were protected. And now they're everywhere. And I kind of thought, almost 50 years ago, that by now, by the time that I'm a 70-year-old woman researcher, that wolves would be graciously accepted as part of our wild landscape. And that absolutely is not true. And I believe, having watched these changes over 5 decades, that people hate wolves more strongly and are more vocal about it now than they were when I was younger. And that is despite the fact that there's been a lot of amazing research done and wolf watching businesses are springing up, you know, around Yellowstone and Alaska, Denali. And yet people have so much vitriol. So I thought, well, you know what? I've watched this wolf population in the West go from one wolf that we collared, the first wolf named Kirshnina, to about 3,000 in the West now. There are wolves in Washington, Oregon, California, Colorado, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana. You know, when I came out here in 79, there was one. And so I have this long history with them. So that was one reason. Secondly, I felt strongly that it's really important that people get accurate information that's objective in a format that they will use. You know, all the academic papers that myself and other scientists have published, nobody ever sees them. But to get it out into a format where people can enjoy it, and that was the third part of my book, was to do it through storytelling. Real stories, they're all nonfiction, they really all happened. And so people can kind of take the ride with you and maybe just open their minds a little bit to other possibilities about wolves, whether you love them or hate them. Didn't matter. I'm not preachy in this book.
So you can be on either side of that fence and still enjoy this read. But also, can we agree that they are an important part of our world? And I think once you peel back some of those layers and get to know these animals and get to understand them better and their patterns and how they work, and they're not the enemy. They are, as you said, they are operating as wolves operate. And so if we can learn to live inside of that understanding or knowledge, it might do us some good.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm hoping that people will moderate a bit on either end. The people in the middle are kind of all where they should be, because wolves have to live in the middle. They don't operate on either extreme of being much hated or much loved. And they're both equally damaging because it just keeps polarizing it more. So yeah, they're part of the ecosystem. And I just tell the science stories and then I let people draw their own conclusions.
Well, I think it's a very interesting read. This is Diane Boyd, a world-renowned wildlife biologist who has spent 4 decades studying and advocating for wolves in the wilds of Montana near Glacier National Park. Thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth. And if people want to go somewhere to learn more about you and learn more about your writing, where should they go? What's a good webpage?
Well, I have a website, DianeKBoyd.com, and that's DianeKBoyd. Or there's all kinds of great wolf informational centers. I'd go look at the International Wolf Center. It's just wolf.org. Or Yellowstone has some great research published on their website, Google Wolves and Yellowstone Park. And there's lots of good stuff out there. And of course, this academic journal, for those who are academic, you can Google, I look at Google Scholar for more academic articles. We do our best to help with wolf conservation, and that's really sharing information and experiences in a good, positive way.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you have an idea, we'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas and topics, your storylines. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. You can also find us wherever you listen to your podcast. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.